Kim.
Thank you, David, and hello, everyone. I had to join a little bit late today. So I'd like to speak now about a bit more detail about the context and nuance that can surround this wise speech practice, as I believe we are beginning to explore, quite experientially, perhaps. So a common issue that comes up in wise speech practice is whether our speech needs to be pleasant or agreeable. People often have questions about this. So the teachings, though, are somewhat nuanced about whether and how we can speak about what is displeasing or not desired by the listener. I would say that overall, the teachings do strongly encourage pleasant and kind and gentle speech, but that there are times when we may need to say what is displeasing, and that would still be within the realm of what's true and beneficial. But nonetheless, we don't always have to speak what is pleasant. So let's talk about that a little bit as demonstrated through some suttas that I'll walk us through. So starting with the encouragement for gentle and kind and beautiful speech, we have this passage from Sutta about Chunda, which is on the 10 courses of skillful action. This is about abandoning harsh speech, one of the things we talked about in the last class. So having abandoned harsh speech, a person abstains from harsh speech. They speak such words as are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. So this is an instruction for how to abandon harsh speech. And then we also have passages from a wonderful monk whose name was Von Gisa. And Von Gisa is really lovely because he was originally, when he was a layperson, he was very caught up in sense pleasure. That was kind of his thing. And then when he ordained and practiced for a long time with his desire, he opened up into this, like this love just opened up in him, such that what he saw was the beauty in each person that he met. And he would often have these kind of poetical, inspired utterances after seeing beautiful people. And the Buddha encouraged Von Gisa to speak his praise. So we have some of these recorded. And this is from in particular, a sutta called Well Spoken. So this is what the Buddha was teaching. And the Buddha was teaching a bhikkhu or a practitioner speaks only what is well spoken, not what is badly spoken. They speak only what is pleasant, not what is unpleasant. And the Buddha goes on along those lines. And then Von Gisa says, oh, I'm inspired to say something about this. And part of what he says is, one should utter only pleasant speech, speech that is gladly welcomed. When it brings them nothing evil, what one speaks is pleasant to others. So again, we have this extolling of beautiful and pleasant speech. And I'm going to get back to Von Gisa later because he had more to say about this. In fact, it goes on now to Von Gisa praising Sariputta, where Sariputta was the Buddha's chief disciple, very wise, but nonetheless, it's talking about how he was instructing, exhorting, inspiring, and gladdening the monks with the Dharma talk. And it says that his speech was polished, clear, articulate, expressing the meaning well. And those bhikkhus were listening with eager ears, attending to it as a matter of vital concern, directing their whole mind to it. So again, we have the speech and we have the listening. And Von Gisa says, oh, as Sariputta teaches them, they listen to his sweet utterance, uplifted in mind, made joyful by his delightful voice, sonorous and lovely. The bhikkhus incline their ears. So there's a lot of this. It's clear enough that pleasant and even delightful speech is really encouraged in the teachings. However, I want to turn now to a sutta that's often quoted about wise speech, which is MN 58, the teaching with Prince Abhaya. And in this, the setup is interesting. The setup for this sutta is that a Jain teacher is wanting to trip up the Buddha and get him caught in by his own teaching, essentially. And so he sends Prince Abhaya to the Buddha with a question. And the question is, would the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, would the Tathagata utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others? So that's the question that's going to be posed to the Buddha. And the Jain teacher is figuring it's going to trip him up, because if he says no, if he says yes, he would utter such speech, then he'll say, well, how are you any different from a regular unenlightened person like all of us? We utter speech all the time that is unpleasant and disagreeable to others. So what's so special about you as the Buddha? However, if the Buddha says, no, I would not utter any speech that's disagreeable to others, then he'll give the example that the Buddha had, in fact, challenged his cousin Devadatta, who was trying to break up the Sangha, and he had spoken some strong speech to him, and Devadatta was unhappy about that. So he can say, but you did speak unpleasant speech to Devadatta. So he's thinking, I'm going to get him tripped up. He can't answer this question. So Prince Abhaya goes to the, goes from the Jain teacher to the Buddha, and he poses this question thinking, okay, now he's going to get tripped up. But what the Buddha says is, there is no one-sided answer to that question. And so he brings in nuance. He doesn't bite on the yes or the no, do you utter unpleasant speech? He says there's no one-sided answer to that. And then he gives a teaching about how we can have a little bit of nuance about how we choose what to say. So he's very clear that we do still need to speak what is true, that doesn't go away, and what is beneficial to the person. But then he adds this line, the realized one knows the right time to speak, so as to explain what he knows to be true, substantial, and beneficial, but what is disliked by others. So he's still saying things that are true, substantive, and beneficial, but he knows the right time to say them if they're going to be unpleasant to others. So the sutta lays out kind of logical criteria about how we can choose when and how to speak. So speech always should be true and beneficial, but its pleasantness can vary with timing. And I think this makes sense, right? We do know that there are times when we've had to say things that were unpleasant, but, it can matter. Sorry if you're hearing a little bit of sound outside. It can matter when we do that. If you want to tell your partner that they really should have cleaned something that they said they were going to do and didn't, and now it's a problem because the guests are coming, the moment to do that is not when they walk in the door with five boxes in their arms saying, I'm so exhausted, and somebody stole our license plate off the car. You don't then say, oh, and by the way, you didn't do that thing. That's not the moment, right? So this is not a hard to understand teaching. That doesn't mean it's always easy to choose, but we get the gist of it. So this has been also analyzed by the scholar Sally King, who went through some of the Buddha's teachings about speech. And she points out that the Buddha did endorse the occasional use of what is called sharp speech. But in her words, good moral judgment is needed to determine when sharp speech should be used. So that's something that it's the same criteria ends up coming up, is that it has to be still true, still beneficial, but said at the right time. So then we can also look in the teachings and see that this is the case with the Buddha speaking to Devadatta and instructing Prince Abhaya, but also we have cases where he spoke to monks in ways that were not especially agreeable to them. Now, these, of course, were people who had ordained with him and so were, committed to practicing these teachings. But we have in, for example, in MN 22, the simile of the snake, which we taught about earlier this year, I think, there's a monk named Arita who is expressing unskillful views that are not in line with what the Buddha teaches. And he's defending them and saying, no, this is really how it is. And so the Buddha calls him to his presence and says, "Misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way?" So that's pretty sharp. And he is criticizing Arutta for his view. And we can understand that, you know, this would be this overt, sharp speech that the Buddha sometimes uses. But it was true. It was beneficial for Arutta and presumably timely because the monk had been called and was asked ahead of time, "Do you actually say this?" And he says, "Yes, I do." So at that moment, he was holding his wrong view. And so the Buddha could say, "No, this is not correct." And it makes sense that this was useful because the Buddha's monks should not be misrepresenting his teachings, right? So this is, you know, the Buddha needs to keep everybody kind of on the same key about that. So, but there are other cases also of modern teachers who use this technique also to help people with their practice, essentially helping with their practice. I'll share this example that Greg Scharf has given. He's another Dharma teacher, has given in Dharma talks where he said that on one of his early retreats, maybe his first retreat, he was had a mind state going that some of us may recognize where he thought that he was the only person who was not being mindful and everybody else looked so good. They looked so peaceful and so, you know, attentive, and his mind was just all over the place and he was sitting and it was just a mess. And so he came into his interview and he said, "I'm the only person here who isn't mindful." And the teacher just looked at him and said, "What makes you so special?" So, you know, this was, she must have judged that at that moment he could handle that. She must have felt in his presence that that would be, but he says he was so glad that she said that. You know, she just did not endorse this whole egoistic mind state of inferiority and challenge and burden and all this. She just cut right through that and said, "What makes you so special?" And then he woke up and realized, oh yeah, right, this might be hard for other people too. It's not only about me. And it was just said with such kindness and clarity that his mind kind of snapped back into mindfulness, and he also softened and realized he was being very hard on himself. So, you know, the right statement at the right time can really cut through, actually, even though it probably wasn't the most pleasant thing for him to hear. He really appreciated it. So we don't want to conflate wise speech with nice speech, you know, with the idea that we can't ever say anything that might be challenging for someone. In fact, I don't know how well anybody would progress on the path if they weren't challenged somewhere along the way. Don't you think you need to be a little challenged, maybe? So, but in the right time, in the right way, with things that are still true. Okay, so returning now to Vanghisa, more from his inspired verse about the Buddha's speech, he says, he goes on to say something rather profound, which is, "Truth indeed is deathless speech. This is an ancient principle. The goal and the Dhamma, the good say, are established upon truth. The secure speech which the Buddha utters for the attainment of Nibbana, for making an end to suffering, is truly the foremost speech." So the foremost speech is somehow coming from the Dharma. Something I believe Diana was alluding to also is that there's something where if we touch in our own heart to what we know of the Dharma, even if we still have ignorance in our mind, there is something true that can flow from that. Probably more so than if we're in our heads checking off boxes. Is it true? Is it beneficial? Is it timely? You know, that can be helpful sometimes, but there's something that can come forth from the heart, coming from a place of whatever degree of non-clinging we can muster at that moment. And this is what the Buddha is doing all the time. He has his heart open, open heart, open mind, like we talked about in the meditation. What comes from that place will be wise speech. So this is a little bit of a twist on how to practice wise speech. Is maybe what we need to do is connect with that place in our heart and try speaking and see if we can speak in an aligned way with the Dharma And notice, if we do that, we will notice when we are not speaking what is true. We will notice when it's not kind, not beneficial. It feels out of line. But if we're saying something that is maybe not agreeable, but has those Dharma qualities to it, it will still feel clean coming from that place. So we might practice wise speech by speaking and observing how it comes out and feeling how it is. And what we will find, I think, is that speech from the Dharma is true, is beneficial, is timely, is non-divisive. All those qualities are simply descriptions of what speech is when it comes from this place in the heart. So I hope that maybe eases up a little bit how we might practice with wise speech, and also points to a more profound dimension of speech, speech that comes from our deepest wisdom and perhaps even from the unconditioned. So perhaps that rounds out this topic at a place where we could step back and see how that's landing for you, and see if you have any questions at this point. David will lead us in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah, we want to sort of provide an opportunity at the end of this session for questions or comment, reflections, what comes up for people around this aspect of speech. We've talked in the last couple times about the utility, the skillfulness of attention to mode, to content, and to these two we add now, I don't have a third hand, mode, content, context. Context also is important, as Kim has amply illustrated. Questions, thoughts? David.
Yeah, Kim wasn't here, but I mean, she spoke directly, I think, to what I was trying to bring up at the beginning. And yeah, I just want to share one thing that occurred to me through all of the class today and in our breakout exercise, is that where the best feelings, it seems to me, about speech and listening come is where there's an underlying valuing, commitment, respect of mutuality, reciprocation. And so you see that's present supposedly in the Sangha, except for those verbal dagger people, you know, they forgot it. I'm sure it was it's there somewhere, but they forgot it. And I think so much then of what we're being taught is beautiful and valuable. What's more challenging, of course, is we're in a world, and you know, the Buddha meant the same thing. There were people who reviled the Buddha, and we're trying to set him up all the time for embarrassment, failure, or worse. You know, that's the challenge from that, you know, I think we all face in this world. And yeah, then that's all I have to say. Thanks.
I think you say something really valuable and wonderful there, David. You implicitly point out that the Buddha didn't really live at a different time from us. If we think of everything from the axial age and, you know, probably important distinctions between the period the Buddha lived in and previous history, although I'm not an expert there. But, you know, as you point out, the things we're talking about, things you mention about today, our contemporary landscape of speech, of discourse, public and private, it's the same world. And so that does make these teachings about mode, content, context, you know, relevant to us. I think, as Kim pointed out, that one of the things we do as practitioners is bring this particular way of seeing clearly, to the extent we have access to it, this particular way of opening the heart into the world. That's maybe the most important aspect of truthful or honest speech that we as practitioners introduce. So thank you for that. That was nicely expressed. Any other? Bill.
If the context is Thanksgiving dinner, when you're with relatives from far-flung corners, you're all there together because you're related, but not because you have the same opinions, then the standard guideline is don't talk about politics or religion. My thought is it can be perfectly fine to talk about politics or religion, but it only works if your only purpose is to understand the other person's point of view, and you have no desire to promote your own point of view. And if everyone does that, it can go great, but it must be difficult because I haven't been able to do that yet. But that's my thought. Just try to understand the other person's point of view, and only that.
Yeah, which, and maybe that's part of some of the listening that we've pointed towards, or even in today's breakout group, that sense of mirroring and reflecting. Also, I think it's worth, this isn't the first time that we've noticed that this class runs up against Thanksgiving. I don't know that we designed it that way, but yeah, hopefully there will be something in here that will help people, in the next few weeks or a couple months as we gather with family and friends. And I would just note that it's something that we mentioned earlier on, Diana mentioned, convincing people of things is hard work. Convincing ourselves of things we don't want to believe is hard enough. But that there are many questions that the Buddha put aside as being questions the resolution of which don't advance practice. And that can be a useful thing to think about, even at the Thanksgiving table. As a practitioner, to the extent we're engaged as practitioners, there's a lot of stuff that advances our practice, opens the heart, opens the mind. Maybe you point to some, Bill. And that may not be directly confronting Uncle. It's always, what is it, Harry, about, their political views. So thank you for that, Bill. And Diana.
Thank you. Maybe I'll just add on there. I don't remember where I heard this first. It was from a Dharma talk. I don't remember who was speaking. They said, no matter how, whatever degree of awakening or new understanding or freedom that you feel like you have, just wait till you go home with your family, because that's where the real kind of test is. And it may all go out the window. So just this, we get sometimes our buttons get pushed, quote unquote, because the buttons got inserted in the same by the same people, right? Perhaps, or I don't know, just kind of a nod. But that also leads to, we're going to talk about this a little bit more explicitly on Saturday about Thanksgiving dinner and some of these conversations and discussions. So stay tuned for that. And so we will send out a handout that has the suttas that I spoke about and Kim spoke about. And also just briefly, when I was speaking, I was excerpting. So I think we'll send you the complete ones. So if you're interested, you can read the complete context in which these conversations. And I'll also say, for me, sometimes I'm following one translation, but I like another translator's use of a word. So sometimes I'll substitute different words. So what you get won't be precisely what I said, but I'll put you there, including what Kim was referring to also. So for between now and Saturday morning when we speak again, this practice, there's a number of ways to think about it, but one is this: what would it be like to speak from a place with an open heart and an open mind? What would that be like? Just to try it out, like, okay, if I were to approach this, if I were to engage in this, and whatever openness we've experienced, we have memories of, or we imagine of open heart, open mind, can we speak from there? And that helps us become sensitive to the context and to show up maybe in a way that we might not otherwise. So I don't know if my co-teachers have anything they'd like to add before we end this morning. No? Okay, so with a lot of warm wishes and a great appreciation for your participating and showing up. It's such a, I don't know, for me, it feels like such a privilege to practice together and to share the Dharma. It's such a beautiful thing. So if you'd like to unmute, we could say goodbye in a unruly way.
So, goodbye.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you, everybody.
Bye. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Be well.
Bye.
Take care.